From WBUR Boston and WRNI Providence, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. And so, the burning questions, who gets the rose? Who gets voted off the island? Who cares? Apparently, an awful lot of Americans. Reality TV is devouring prime time and leaving sitcoms and TV dramas way out in the cold. Tonight, On Point, the massive appeal of what they call real. But first tonight, taking the world's economic temperature in Davos, 2,000 business leaders attended the World Economic Forum in Switzerland this week. They came looking for solace and found the blues. David Wessel, columnist for the Wall Street Journal, just got back from Switzerland. I asked him to describe the mood in Davos.
The mood is one of great angst at the World Economic Forum in Davos, which drew about 2,000 leaders of companies and governments and non-governmental organizations. They seem pretty worried.
You say it's a combination of catharsis, being there, talking about their woes, and angst that just won't quit.
Yeah, you know, you sit there at a conference like this where there are big conference rooms and people sit in armchairs on the stage like as if it was a TV talk show, or you go to dinners where six or eight people sit around and talk, or you interview you people one-on-one. And it suddenly struck me one day that all these people were like worried adolescents going to a therapist and confessing what their worries were in the hopes that somehow talking about them would make them feel better.
So what is it? What is keeping the powerful up at night?
Well, the first thing that a lot has been written about this already is the fear that war with Iraq will be both violent and disruptive economically and might weaken the international institutions and alliances that are vital to peace and prosperity in the future.
Pretty fundamental issues.
Right. But I was interested in what they were thinking beyond that, since that was the thing that got so much attention. And I found three things that struck me. The first is that India and Mexico in particular are terrified about China, particularly about China's ability to manufacture things cheaply. And in the United States, we often think of our jobs moving overseas, but a lot of the places they've moved overseas to, low-wage countries like Mexico or Thailand or Malaysia or India, are now facing a country that has even cheaper labor, China, and an almost unlimited supply.
So the manufacturing drain that the United States felt is now being felt even by low-wage companies to the lower-wage China.
Absolutely. One guy who's in the manufacturing business told me about Microsoft moving production of the Xbox game console from Hungary to China. And it's that Ross Perot giant sucking sound. It's just not our jobs that are being sucked away this time.
So that will keep folks up, not just in the U.S., but as you say, even in India and Mexico, the vast population of China churning out manufacturers. What else is on the minds of the powerful?
The second thing is there seems to be a great deal of fear of complacency in Europe. People had been hoping for some time that the European economy, the Western European economy, was about to take off, and it never seems to do so. And the businessmen I talk to are convinced that politicians won't embrace the kind of change that has to be made in labor markets or taxes or the red tape it takes to start a company.
These are the long vacations in Germany and the endless bureaucracy elsewhere.
Absolutely. That won't change until people are dissatisfied. And what they're worried about is that people aren't dissatisfied enough. The chief financial officer of a big German insurance company observed to me that Germans labor under what he called an illusion of satisfactory underperformance.
I.e., it's good enough even though it's not competitive any longer?
Absolutely. And for them, their angst is that their people aren't upset enough about the condition they find themselves in. So they settle for 10% unemployment in Germany, or they try and find ways to prolong outdated regulations that don't seem to solve the problems they were designed to solve, but make economic progress difficult.
But it may work for now, but won't work forever. What about the Japanese? They've been in a ditch for a long time already.
Right. The Japanese aren't complacent. The ones I heard in Japan were just incredibly depressed. They stand up and flagellate themselves for the shortcomings of their system and see really little hope. They dismiss the government's promises of doing something as just more talk and less action. I was struck when Haizo Takanaka, who's the Minister for Economy and Banks, who's seen as one of the leading reformers, talked about designating special deregulatory zones in Japan, which he said just like the ones they have in China. A remarkable place for a country like Japan to be looking for clues as to how to make capitalism work.
A country with one of the world's very largest economies.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly.
So after all their woe, Japan still doesn't see themselves coming around the bend?
No, they don't.
And the U.S., what about the Americans? There were plenty of Yanks among the troops here. Are they dour also or something else?
Well, the businessmen from the United States who went to Davos were the survivors. The people whose companies failed or who are out of work don't fly business class to Switzerland in January. Mm-hmm. And so they tended to be optimistic. They tended to be people who argued that once we get the war with Iraq behind us, that the economy will come back and my company is so lean and mean, I'm going to make a lot of money.
So maybe the American dream will lead us out here again, that the optimism remains?
It does, but there are a number of industries where people express fear that what's going on is not an ordinary recession, but a change in the economy that they haven't figured out yet. And airlines and telecommunication and even the business of music, they confess to nagging fears that they simply aren't sure how to make money in this economy. Their old business models are flawed, and they haven't found new ones yet. I mean, I was amazed that the chief executive of AT&T, the big telephone company, stood up and told a joke in front of an audience, and the joke was that I had a bad dream last night that I woke up and I was the chairman of AT&T.
Oh, jeez. It's not a joke you want to hear. It almost sounds, David, like you're describing the sort of end of an era with all kinds of accumulated woes and fears. Where does the dam break into a golden new age here?
I don't think we know yet when this will all break. The optimist says that once we get the anxiety over Iraq behind us, we will storm out of this thing. But the pessimists say the risks are so daunting that they fear that the fear itself will paralyze people. I was struck by an observation that the head of consulting firm Bain & Company, a woman named Ori Gadish, made, someone who's in her past life was deputy chief of staff of the Israeli army or something. Mm-hmm. So she's seen
she knows trouble.
She knows trouble. And she described what was going on now as a case of chronic ongoing uncertainty. And using a medical metaphor, she says a chronic condition is much more insidious than an acute one because the option of just being paralyzed and not doing anything seems so attractive. So the fear of fear may paralyze people and may prolong this soft economy for a while.
Well, no joy in Davos, it sounds like. We'll look for that chronic fever ultimately to break. David Wessel, thanks for the report from the front.
A pleasure.
David Wessel is a columnist for The Wall Street Journal. He spoke with us earlier from Washington. America is awash in reality TV. Here's a sampling of what's on.
I think at this point in the game, everyone could be playing everyone. I'm wondering if I'm the next target. Logically, I would think that I am. I mean, I won an immunity and I won a reward, so I may be perceived to be physically and mentally strong.
Ted, the tribe has spoken.
Damn it, Howard!
What?
You burned my fucking turkey!
What are you talking about?
I told you to fucking put it on low!
You told me to put it on broil.
I said put it on low, not f***ing broil. Look at it. You burn it.
I thought you said broil.
Get out of my face.
Come on.
Just get out of my face.
I've got to put you out of my mind this time.
Thank you very much indeed.
I think this guy's in the top 5% in vote and voices
agree.
We've heard.
Yes, okay. To Hollywood.
Yes to Hollywood. Come back
to Hollywood.
Work it out.
What we're doing with that tattoo, you've got that there for the rest of your f***ing life. So you've got, I'll be
like, I like it.
I'm telling you, Kelly, if you get that infection, that one got infected, this one went up one time, and my f***ing arm came up like a balloon on my fingers, and I couldn't move.
It's really difficult because we're getting farther on into the process. I really didn't think that you could be in love with more than one person at the same time, but I'm thinking that feeling may be changing in me.
Now, because there are four of us, everybody's very suspicious, and there's fewer people to spread
Eric
the suspicion.
Eric has done several things which seem to look like he's informed.
Kathy looked very calm and relaxed and rested, like she hadn't really done very much.
Scenes from The Survivor, The Anna Nicole Show, American Idol, The Osbournes, The Bachelorette, and Celebrity Mole. But then, odds are, you knew that. Reality television, as it's known, is huge. Even the mega hit The West Wing is feeling the sting of The Bachelorette in all the important ratings battles. Just 3 years after Survivor broke the mold, reality programming is changing the landscape of American television in ways few could have imagined. So gone are the twin beds of the old Dick Van Dyke Show days. Even Seinfeld is ancient history. Now it's real Trista and her real bachelors having real intimate dates on real yachts for all the world for you to see. The impact reaches far beyond the TV screen. Actors are out of work. Economics are upside down. Americans are locked in fascination onto themselves, eating worms and dating strangers. Do reality shows have their hooks into you? Which ones and why? And what's behind the explosion of reality TV? You can join the conversation tonight at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Joining me now from Basking Ridge, New Jersey, is Bill Carter, national media reporter for the New York Times. Good evening and welcome, Bill Carter.
Nice to talk to you, Tom.
Great to have you with us. And from State College, Pennsylvania, Clay Calvert, author of Voyeur Nation, Media, Privacy, and Peering in Modern Culture. He's also professor of communications and law at Penn State University. Good evening and welcome, Clay Calvert.
Good evening to you too, Tom. Thanks for having me.
Bill Carter, you've been writing about this. How big is the phenom, and where did it come from? It seems like only yesterday it was just Survivor, and now it's wall-to-wall reality TV.
Well, it's big. It's big, and it's going to get bigger. I think we're seeing basically the beginning of a gigantic wave, and what's driving it is the enormous success that these shows are experiencing right now, especially American Idol, which I think is going to be the biggest of all, which is now on the Fox network, mm-hmm. and Joe Millionaire and The Bachelorette on Fox and ABC, both of which are doing extremely well. And I think the answer about where it came from actually probably is Europe. What happened is that these shows were developed in Europe, a lot of them, and broke through there first, and the formats were sold to the United States, and many of them have been successful here.
Clay Calvert, we heard there in the clips from Survivor the voice saying the tribe has spoken, the American tribe has spoken. Americans are just pouring into onto the sofa to watch these shows. It's not everything that's hot in Europe becomes hot here. What is it about our moment, our culture, this particular place in time that has Americans just sucking this stuff up as fast as it's put out there?
Well, I think a couple of things are at stake here, probably. One is it's fairly light viewing, obviously. Nobody takes it really too seriously. So at a time of crisis and problems in the economy or the potential war with Iraq, maybe we need diversions from that. That's one aspect of appeal. I think the other aspect is that these people are ostensibly real. Now, they're put into contrived situations. So we're talking about reality TV. We've got to be pretty careful about saying reality.
We sure do.
These are really just game shows, only they're not guessing trivia on Jeopardy now. They're you know, matching wiles or wits in other ways. But I think because they're one step closer to us than actors who are one step removed playing a role, I think that also has a point of appeal for us.
Bill Carter, what's the trend? Survivor was fairly straightforward. It's getting more and more exotic. You've reported that ABC has now purchased a show from the UK called Wife Swap. What the heck is that, and what does it tell us about where we're headed?
Well, that one certainly has a provocative title. I think that one is more going to be along the lines of Mom Swap. Essentially, what they're going to do is take a mother out of a family, put her in a different family for 2 weeks, and obviously they switch. So the families have to be, you know, adapt to this new woman in the family. That, by the way, is in England right now and is an enormous hit. I think Survivor has done a remarkable job of reinventing itself with each new go-round. And one thing that's interesting about that show, I think it's extremely well produced. A lot of these shows are underestimated in how well they're being produced and how, you know, skillfully they're edited and formatted to keep people coming back week after week. And I think you're going to see only more of that as time goes on.
Well, more and more. But does it necessarily mean wilder and wilder?
Well, sometimes the wilder ones may not be that successful. I think what you have to do in these shows is connect somehow with, you know, something basic in a large group of the audience. Now, look at American Idol. It's really just another talent show.
Yes,
that's been on television for, you know, centuries practically. Mm-hmm. But it's caught the zeitgeist of people because it's kind of aspirational. People want to be stars. And also, it's just formatted in a way that's extremely entertaining. We used to have variety shows on television. We don't have them anymore. This is a new way of doing it. People identify with these people trying to be successful, and they love the aspect of the judges, you know, tearing them up and making fun of them. It becomes, you know, high entertainment. But that show really is not wild. It's very conventional.
And we call it reality TV. We're talking about the new landscape of American television tonight, reality TV. Why are we throwing out TV drama for so-called reality? Do these shows have their hooks into you? Which one? Why? Join us. 1-800- 423-8255. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking tonight about the new landscape of American television. It is, as you know, reality TV. What's going on in American culture that has us yearning to see our fellow citizens run around in loincloths and eat worms? You can join us tonight at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. My guests tonight are Bill Carter, national media correspondent for the New York Times, and Clay Calvert, author of Voyeur Nation, Media, Privacy, and Peering in Modern Culture. Clay Calvert, this is more than what's just coming across from Europe. It's more than just the traditional variety show. As you say, it's not reality, really. It's kind of mediated reality. It's clearly set up and contrived. But yet, Americans are preferring to see that over traditional TV drama, over sitcoms. What's going on there? Is this the postmodern culture coming out? We can't suspend disbelief anymore for stories. What is it?
Well, you know, it's partly, as you said, it's the new landscape. And part of the appeal here is that to us, these are new shows. These are new genres. They're new varieties. They might have started in Europe, but to many of us, they're still new. It's not the standard situation comedy that is scripted. It's not the standard medical drama like ER or a lawyer drama like L.A. Law or The Practice. It's something different. And even though it's a new landscape, as Bill was saying, these really have old themes. I mean, the competition, the talent show, love and romance, the fish out of water kind of theme, putting someone in another context, the surprise, but the love and romance, the competition, all these are really old themes, and now they're just packaged up in a new format, and I think that the new genre here is appealing, and the wave is indeed rising, and you know, the saturation stage, I don't think we've reached it yet. Probably in the fall, maybe.
It may be old themes, but when you watch people watch this television, they're reacting in different ways. People don't get as wrapped up in the plot line of a TV drama because someone wrote it. That seem to be willing to suspend disbelief long enough to buy that there's a real conflict going on in the mind of the guy courting the bachelorette or the survivor trying to figure out how to make the next level of the game.
Absolutely, and I think that's part of the appeal there is that we can speculate what would we do if we were in that situation, or if it's a female in the audience and she says, what would I do to win Joe Millionaire? Or maybe that audience member would want to feel superior and say, you know, I would never stoop to that low, or I would see through that guy. But we can speculate, I think is what you're suggesting here, about what we would do, and we can relate then more easily than simply to an actor who's playing a role. So we put ourselves in their positions, and we get to, you know, dip in and out, and then when the show's over, we don't have to worry about it. And also, like unlike a drama, we don't have to really worry about following the storyline too well or think too deeply while we're watching it. Just light fluff.
Point out here is that there's a real generational thing going on. These shows are enormously popular with young people, enormously popular, far more popular than scripted shows are. And what's concerning the television industry is that they think there could be a fundamental shift going on, that the audience, the younger audience, is tired, particularly of the sitcom format, of the set-up joke inside a, you know, a fake living room around a sofa, that audience just doesn't respond to that anymore. They're much more attuned to instant gratification entertainment. They like seeing something really fast, really fast-paced, and very superficial. And this speaks to them in a way that a scripted show simply doesn't, and it could be that there's something significantly different about what's going to happen in television in the future because this younger audience is responding to this and not to scripted television shows.
We can only imagine that it could be very different indeed. Bill Carter, you quote the president of CBS saying the world as we knew it is over. Is that a fair portrayal of how television executives are looking at this change in appetites?
Well, they tend to look at things like this and immediately draw gigantic conclusions. So you have to sort of take it with a bit of a grain of salt.
Though it does look pretty big. You look in the TV guide now, and some nights it's practically wall-to-wall reality TV.
What I noted in my story, which was on page one last week, was that Monday, Tuesday, and Wednesday of that week, there were 18 half-hour time periods in network television. Reality shows won 15 of those hours and finished second in the other three. So nobody in network television is going to look at that and not say, wow, we have a sea change going on here, and we've got to react to it. In fact, people at NBC are saying, our problem is we didn't have enough failure in the first part of the season, so we weren't desperate enough to throw on a reality show that could become a big hit.
And they wish they had.
They wish they had, yes.
Bill Carter, Clay Calvert, stand by. We're joined right now by Jeff Gaspin. He's Executive VP of Alternate Series Programming for NBC. Good evening and welcome, Jeff Gaspin.
Hi, how are you?
Great. How's the weather in Burbank, California tonight?
It's beautiful out here. Thank you.
Great. Tell us, what is it about reality TV? Why so very huge? Did you anticipate this 12 months ago, 24 months ago? When did it become clear to everyone that this was a giant wave?
Well, I think this is the second giant wave. About 2-3 years ago, there was the first giant wave with Millionaire and Survivor and then Fear Factor. And then it seemed to calm down a little bit last year. There was some failure of reality shows. And then I think probably sometime last April when The Bachelor came back out, and then in the summer there was such tremendous success with shows like Dog Eat Dog, Meet My Folks, and American Idol, I think we saw that the wave was coming again. Not a lot of the networks actually had it scheduled in the fall of this year. But then as there was failure in television, as Bill Carter was talking about before, some of the other networks started to put it on. NBC did not have that failure, so we didn't have the need to put it on. And then, of course, you see the results of American Idol and The Bachelorette right now and Joe Millionaire.
And you
realize this is something that's not going away.
Jeff Gaspin, so how is the industry feeling about being strapped onto this rocket that's come back? Are you ecstatic, terrified, baffled? What's the implication?
I think all of those things. We're excited that audiences are coming back to network television because for many years, you know, people like Bill Carter, rightfully so, have been writing how the broadcasters are losing audience to cable.
Right.
I would suspect if you looked at the ratings for the last few weeks, you're getting a lot more people coming back to broadcast, and that's certainly exciting to us. We have huge investments in scripted programs, so it's not like we're looking for reality to take over what has worked very well for us, what has been very lucrative for us. But you can't not respond to the kind of numbers that you're seeing now.
And right now it looks like it is taking over. Is that likely to last, or do you see this wave kind of sweeping through and then we're back on the couch watching drama, sitcom?
I think the wave will sweep through, but I think the level of the ocean is a bit higher when it comes to reality, to continue on the metaphor.
And does it work for the industry financially? Is it better or worse than pumping out dramas?
If you're a writer, it doesn't work out better.
No,
if
doesn't.
You are a reality producer, it absolutely works out better.
And overall, for the company's bottom lines?
It depends. You know, these traditionally have not been as accepted to advertisers as scripted programs have. Mm-hmm. So you do have that dilemma that it might cost less from a program point of view, but it might not generate as much revenue from an advertiser point of view.
Although that's changing, isn't it, Jeff? Because advertisers now see advantages in reality TV, particularly in terms of product placement.
Some advertisers. Our understanding is about a third of all advertisers really do embrace reality TV. There's still a lot of advertisers that do not.
It's hard to imagine an advertiser not embracing a show like American Idol, though.
I think American Idol, you know, probably does fine with advertisers.
Bill Carter, how do you see NBC's performance in the herd here?
Well, NBC, as I said, is in a funny position. They were so successful with their scripted programming, and particularly they have a premium audience that they draw that's a high-income audience with their programming. So they get, you know, extra money from advertisers for shows like West Wing and Friends and ER and shows like that. So they didn't have a crying need for it. But television is always like this. When you're desperate, you try anything. And sometimes when you do that, that's when you really hit the ball out of the park. And so when you have a good scripted programming right now, you're not going to have a very, very big hit. No huge hit has been introduced in the scripted form except CSI on CBS for the last 4 years, whereas there have been 3 or 4 or 5 reality shows. So I know NBC's philosophy right now is let's get into it, let's look for that big hit, and let's try to use the summer as an incubation period. I think Jeff has how many, 9 or 10 reality shows?
Yeah, we have quite a few series for the summer, everything from Next Action Star to Last Comic Standing.
You're a very busy man on the reality front. Jeff Gaspin, we've heard from Bill Carter and Clay Calvert their interpretation of why this has suddenly become such catnip for American viewers. How do you interpret it? What's going on here?
I don't think it happened overnight. I think that younger viewers, you know, viewers in the last 20 years have grown up with Nickelodeon, MTV, VH1, many cable channels that relied heavily on reality-type television. So it's been part of their television viewing for a long time. They're now coming of age where they really start watching the broadcasters, and the broadcasters haven't given those viewers the type of programming that they like as part of their programming mix. Now, all of a sudden, you know, they're realizing the broadcasters are giving them that, and they're finding it in waves.
But why is it this instead of narrative, instead of sitcom, instead of drama?
I think they're willing to watch a sitcom and a drama. I just, you know, I think they like reality as part of that appetite. We still get huge ratings for some of our sitcoms and some of our dramas. We now have huge ratings for reality as well.
Well, Jeff Gaspin, you're in the right place at the right time. Good luck to you. Thanks for joining us tonight.
Thank you.
Jeff Gaspin joined us from Burbank, California. He's Executive Vice President of Alternate Series Programming for NBC. You can join the conversation tonight. What's going on in American culture that has us yearning to see our fellow citizens run around in loincloths and eat worms? We're at 1-800-423-8255. Eric's calling. Hi, Eric. You're on the air.
Hi, how are you doing today?
Good, thanks.
I was calling. My point is that, you know, I'm 31 and have grown up with MTV and the Real World and Road Rules for the last 10 years.
Right.
And so your comments earlier from your guest that this is all coming from Europe is, I think, not completely correct because, you know, my friends and people that I see on the weekends and at dinner parties, we've always grown up in this over the last 10 years, and everyone loves Real World, and I think finally network TV finally caught on to the concept.
Well, we know a lot of the show ideas came from Europe, but what is it, Eric, that attracts you to a reality TV show, quote unquote, as opposed to a sitcom or a TV drama?
It's, you know, it's not canned. It's although it's not real and it may be contrived to a certain degree, at least you feel that you can connect with these people. And I can't remember how many times I've been having dinner with someone and the conversation turns to TV and you're like, can you believe what happened in Real World last week? You know, what's going on in Real World Las Vegas or whatever? And you really connect and you have something that you feel and you can sit and talk about it. Not, you know, can you believe what happened on Seinfeld or now, you know, Friends? Well, that's just a silly comedy that you laugh for 20 minutes, then you forget about it as soon as it's over.
You can really talk about it. There's something right in the middle of that, Eric. Thanks for your call. Clay Calvert, you hear that. It's the notion, even though what you call it mediated, and I guess at some level mediated voyeurism, but the notion that there's something really going on, a live dynamic to talk about here. Is this another instance of us not having neighbors' lives that we know about, so we know about what's going on The Bachelorette?
I don't think it's that disturbing or anything like that. I think the caller, Eric, is absolutely right in terms of the Real World. Kind of, it's a generation that's been weaned on the Real World. And as he was mentioning the shows there, I was thinking about them. Each of those Real World shows has pushed the envelope a little bit further in testing our mores about sexual behavior or conduct. Mm-hmm. From the initial ones were rather tame, and now we're in Las Vegas after the Chicago series. And that show's pretty out there right now. And so this is a generation that's been weaned on the idea that it's okay to put yourselves in these positions, that there's a certain sense of validation of these people's lives who go on these shows, but I don't think it's harmful at all, and I don't think people should be overly concerned that they were watching this at all. It's just the format that people have grown up on.
Another interesting aspect of this drama that I have a theory about, which is that for a younger generation of people, it is not in the least bit unconventional for the regular people to be living their lives on camera. A lot of young kids in America today have grown up with virtually all of their lives documented on videotape.
Mom and Dad always have the camera out and
it's
rolling.
Precisely. So it's perfectly normal and average for them to be looking voyeuristically at other people's lives because their own lives have been documented.
The evolution of the Kodak moment. Stan's calling from Lexington, Massachusetts. Hi, Stan. You're on the air.
Hi. Thanks for taking the call,
Good Tom.
I'd like perhaps for your guests to reflect on the fact that this doesn't look too different from the Roman circus or the modern-day Roman circus where it crowds out other, you know, programmings and may well be the result of the conglomeration of media in the United States.
How do you draw that connection, Stan?
Well, so, for example, if you watch, for example, CNN, you will see the first story is all about, you know, who won the sweeps with regard to movies, and then the next story is who's winning on their associated or affiliated reality show. Or Fox News is probably a better example, where Rupert Murdoch's marketing his reality TV through his news programming. In the meantime, people, you know, have demonstrated a, you know, pretty high, low level of political literacy, so they're poorly informed about matters of the economy, war and peace, and that kind of thing.
But very well informed about The Bachelorette. Stan, you raise a great point. Stick with us here. I want to hear from both Bill and Clay on this. I can't help noticing this thing, same thing Stan does. I guess I could be accused of it myself tonight. We're talking about reality TV, and yet reporting in what goes on in reality TV shows increasingly shows up around the edge of news, as though it's almost an alternative news stream, Bill Carter.
Well, it's certainly true that people now in the news media, look for things that are, you know, phenomena in the culture and try to capture them in the news reporting because they think it'll drive ratings. I mean, that's unfortunately true. When it's Oscar season, you'll see a tremendous amount of reporting about the Oscars because that's what people are talking about in terms of the culture. And right now, the culture is paying an awful lot of attention to these reality shows. Now, I think the caller is right that on the Fox network, you're going to see an awful lot about Joe Millionaire and American Idol because it helps generate, you know, viewing for something else that the company owns. Mm. And this is all this part of this vertical integration of these big conglomerates.
But, Stan, let me ask you, hasn't television for a long time, maybe always, been the Roman circus of American life?
Well, I would suggest that it's this conglomeration has meant that there's been more news space devoted to not just what happened or what's going on in the American, viewing viewing taste, but is devoted to what's about to happen, what you should see, why you should see it, and that crowds out, information about essential issues about
the rest of the world, and it certainly does take up a big position there.
People don't know that there's a sanctions regime that's really hurting the average Iraqis, and that they're not particularly happy about what's going on there.
Stan, we've got it. Thanks for your call. Mary's calling. Welcome, Mary. You're on the air.
Hi. I think I want to back up what Stan was just saying. I'm in my 40s, and okay. I think the reality shows are picking up audience from even my demographic. The first thing I do when I get up in the morning is I turn on the news nowadays to see what disaster has happened elsewhere. And during the day, I check in on the BBC, et cetera, et cetera.
It can get pretty grim.
When I get home at night, if I'm going to turn on an hour of TV, I want it to be complete escapism.
So no apologies. You want that escape, and so-called reality TV gives it to you. I guess that's a measure, Mary, of how unrealistic it may be.
Well, indeed. There is nothing more entertaining than just watching doofuses from across the country make fools of themselves, and that's the essential, that's the theory behind reality TV, and it's a really nice balance to the drenching in news.
I might add there, we have the retread doofuses as well now on, like, the Surreal Life. And bringing back all these stars and the Celebrity Mole and all these has-beens have come back in here as well. And that's kind of that pure fun of seeing something from another generation come back and people just enjoying and goofing off of that.
And doofuses from across the country. Mary, thanks for your call. Kate Calvert, there you hear very clearly the sort of the plea for something that's just doofus is doing doofusy things because reality is a bit too much sometimes.
Yeah, I mean, it is the escapism. The escapism factor's there, and it's the idea that we need to escape from it. I mean, let's face it. The same people are saying, well, we would all be watching political shows. I don't think the same people who are watching these shows would necessarily say, well, now I'm going to go watch CNN tonight. They would be watching a sitcom if that weren't there, or they'd be on a cable channel more likely watching a program or a movie or something else. It's not as if these shows are taking up everything.
There, you are no doubt right. We're talking about the new landscape of American television tonight. What makes this reality TV catnip to the American mind 2003? You can join us tonight. 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking tonight about the new landscape of American television. It is, reality TV. What's going on here? Have we told all our stories? Have we tapped out the TV drama vein, the urge for sitcoms? Is reality TV the new great escape? Is there an ounce of reality in reality TV? You can join us tonight at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. My guests tonight have been Bill Carter, national media reporter for the New York Times, and Clay Calvert, professor of communications and law at Penn State University. We're joined now from New York City by Rory Evans, a freelance editor and semi-professional television watcher. Good evening and welcome, Rory Evans.
Hi.
So, are you watching, and what are you watching, and is reality TV high on your list, Rory Evans?
Oh, it's high on my list of the TV that I watch, and I do watch a lot of television. I feel like there's no escaping it right now, and so I watch the romance reality, I watch Joe Millionaire, and I watch The Bachelorette.
So why do we care who gets the rose?
I'm not sure. Well, I say I'm more interested in Joe Millionaire than The Bachelorette, although I think it was because Joe Millionaire I started watching The Bachelorette.
Are you interested because of the lie at the heart of the show, the kind of trick bottom in the suitcase, or because he's a hunky guy?
No, I don't think I'm either. I'm not interested in the lie, and I'm not interested in his looks because I do not find him attractive at all. I just think that there's something heartbreaking and compelling about it, and just watching the women and, like, watching him and sort of what a sham it all is, and, like, the fact that none of the women there have a meter to figure out that, like, what he's peddling isn't right. I mean, like, the place that they're staying is so tacky, and everything he does is tacky, and...
So it's terrific. I mean, you're really bothered by the obvious flaws in the reality of unreal reality TV.
Right, exactly. Like, it really bothers me that he doesn't have a Sub-Zero refrigerator. Like, the
it's so wrong. Listen, I want to ask you this, Rory. What do you think about the way women are portrayed in these shows? Portrayed, used, call it what you will, compared to the treatment of men?
Well, I mean, I know that there was a story, I forget, and I want to say it was in the Times about the language that's used on The Bachelorette and how when it was The Bachelor, it was, when they were doing the elimination process, it was whose heart is going to be broken,
yeah.
And for the men, it was whose ego will be crushed, and... Mm-hmm.
Hearts and egos, it's the old story.
Yeah, exactly. But I think that the most compelling person on The Bachelorette is Trista, and it's not because she's smart, and there's just something about her that, but I also think that the way she talks about the guy that I think she likes and the guy that I think she will end up with, she talks about him in a very insecure fashion.
You know, I saw 5 minutes of that last night, and I just couldn't fathom what was really in Trista's mind. I mean, there's a drama within a drama. She's on TV. Can she really like any of these guys? Are these instant actors being made out of ordinary citizens thrust into reality TV?
Yeah, well, I think that there are people who are out there auditioning for jobs on television or in the entertainment industry, and when something like this comes up, they take the opportunity to, you know, show off their poetry writing skills or their songwriting skills.
But surely not really themselves, or is it? Is that really Trista?
I think it kind of is. I don't know. I mean, I also think that she has a really, like, there's so many, like, heartbreaking scenes in that, like, the hackney stuff that the guys do to impress her, and she totally falls for it, and... I think that like among me and my friends, we're captivated by it because it's so cheesy and it's so tacky, and we can't. And that's what we're always calling the guys out on, being so trite and being so unoriginal. And
but you are not alone. Everybody is captivated one way or another. The audiences are huge. Stand by, Rory Evans. Aaron's calling. Hi, Aaron. You're on the air.
Hi. How are you?
Good. Thanks.
I think these reality shows bring together people in a way that other shows don't.
Why?
Well, for example, my family's kind of unusual in that my in-laws live with me, and they have recently immigrated from the Ukraine.
Okay.
They don't speak much English, mm-hmm. and they're in their 60s. When we sit down at the television together, what we like and what we can understand are very different. But the reality shows, once you understand the framework of what is happening, the emotions are kind of more raw than you would get in a scripted show. The stories are kind of more natural. And I think it appeals to a broader age range.
Aaron, you're making so many great points here. And I guess I'm picturing your house with the Ukrainian immigrant in-laws watching reality TV. You may have your own reality TV show going on there with the family gathered around. But I want Clay Calvert, if you can pick up on what Aaron's saying, the way that even if it's verisimilitude, the feeling that this is real, that people's emotions and egos and hearts are really on the line, creates a very powerful nexus for conversation, for sharing emotion and ideas among viewers.
Absolutely. And television has always had that power to give us a shared conversation, a sustained community, actually. We always talk about shows the next day. In this case, as the caller was just saying, Aaron was saying, we share these conversations now with our family. And also, I think the idea she raises is very important, that people from all different backgrounds can come down. They don't have to have a lot of education or sophistication or background or all be on the same wavelength really going in. People from different parts of the world can watch the same thing and get the same part out of it. I think she's absolutely right.
Aaron, thanks for your call. Mike's calling. Welcome, Mike. You're on the air.
Hi. I just wanted to make one comment. Mm-hmm. Seems to me that the original reality TV shows are the original game shows.
Yeah.
I mean,
yeah.
Just, you know, we have real-life people. No one knows the outcome until it happens, and there is no real script. There's a basic structure, but there's no script.
So the Gong Show, the Newlywed Show, that was reality of its time.
Exactly, exactly.
Bill Carter, how about it? Is that the taproot?
Well, those are the right ones to point out, because if you go back further and you look at The Price is Right or shows like that, it isn't that real because you don't get to know the people that well. But the Gong Show is the perfect example, because one of the elements of the show, of these shows that people haven't mentioned, is that there's a humiliation factor that
it
seems
sure
to appeal
is.
To people, mm-hmm. that people are embarrassed by these people, that there's something they do that's usually they're exposing themselves in a way that we like looking at. There is a voyeuristic quality.
It almost seems the ultimate moment. I've watched rooms full of people sit transfixed when someone is about to be booted out of the group to
exactly.
watch their face.
The ultimate rejection. We've all had rejection. Well, now we're watching someone else be rejected, and it's sort of like, you know, there's a traffic accident quality to it. We got to see it.
Mike, thanks for your call. Larry's calling. Welcome, Larry. You're on the air.
Excellent show this evening, Bill. And that last point was perfect. It's human nature to watch someone either go down in flames
right.
or hopefully hook up. And it's the titillation factor of these shows. And it's hysterical.
So they set up those situations again and again. You can count on it. You know there's going to be humiliation. There's going to be hooking up. There's going to be failure, defeat, victory.
But the best part is going back to Stan's comment earlier is about the political ignorance of people who don't pay attention to the country, what's really going on, because they're watching reality TV. And if you could hire these editors to take over C-SPAN, you might even have something worth watching.
But, Larry, you know, in a TV drama, you could take world themes and work them into a story. That seems to be explicitly being rejected in this movement to reality TV.
Well, I still think that there's so much reality going on all around us. It's far more frightening and exciting than what's happening in someone's tiny little world. And it's semi-contrived in the situations they create. And there's a lot of reality TV out there that's really happening, and some of it people should be paying a little more attention to. It's like I said, if people were engaged, if the editing, the quality, the way these shows are presented, quick editing and in your face and capturing the emotions, which is great. But if you could do that with government, current events, you know, it's just so much more of a learning experience. It really gets someone.
Take it to Baghdad, and maybe we will. Larry, thanks for your call. Clay Calvert, I keep coming back to this, but the idea that watching people be humiliated, embarrassed, have their heart broken, or at least the appearance of a broken heart, is somehow more warm and fuzzy and charming than the true reality that surrounds these shows.
That's right, and we love to watch it. As the caller was saying, as you were just saying, we love to watch people have their hearts broken. That is not a new phenomenon. And I think part of it, actually, is one of the earlier callers was suggesting that we get to critique these people. In a sense, we feel superior to them in
oh,
a way.
Yeah.
We say, God, aren't we fortunate we're not in that position? Or I've been there. I can relate to it. But God, I'm not like them. Or, you know, I'm smarter than those other women on that show. I mean, that was what I was getting there. And I was like, that's kind of an interesting phenomenon running through this, too, that we can say, what would we do? Oh, we wouldn't be like them. And that kind of reinforces where we stand and we feel better about ourselves and that we would do something differently in these cases.
Bill Carter, is this a one-way street? How long does this run go on?
Well, no one ever knows in television because television is made of these cycles that come and go. I tend to agree with what Jeff Gassman said earlier in the sense that we're going to see a gigantic wave. There's going to be so many of these on the next 6 to 12 months that it will just saturate people's attention for a long, long time. But as long as people come up with unique formats and interesting formats, breakthrough ideas, I think those will stick with you. And they'll always be, perhaps for at least the near term, there'll be some of these on the schedule. Incidentally, they're trying to do even things that are substantive. You might say one network, I think it's a cable network, is doing a reality show about a presidential candidate, picking a presidential candidate who will run for the next presidential election.
This is an ersatz candidate, or at least one chosen on TV by TV.
Right.
Wow, what a world. That's reality as we do and do not know it. Bill Carter, thank you so much for joining us tonight.
Thanks for having me.
Bill Carter is national media reporter for the New York Times, and Rory Evans in New York. Thank you for being with us.
Thank you.
And Clay Calvert in State College, Pennsylvania, author of Voyeur Nation, Media Privacy and Peering into Modern Culture. Thank you for being with us tonight.
Thank you very much.
Listeners, you can continue the reality TV conversation online at onpointradio.org. Click on forums. In a moment, a reality wannabe talks about his failure to land a part on his favorite show. This is On Point. All right, tell the truth. Have you ever dreamed of being the next American Idol, of winning the heart of the bachelor or the bachelorette, of being the next American Idol in spades? New York City resident Chris Locke has taken that dream a step further. He has auditioned for reality television shows three times, and he's never made the cut. In this radio diary, Chris Locke says his desire to be on a reality TV show like Survivor, which he tried out for, is about fulfilling fantasies, not about the huge cash rewards given to the show's victors.
Money wasn't the prime motivator for me. For me, it was more just the experience of doing that, because I've never done anything like that before. Being on an island or in the desert or wherever they are that season, and having to live off the fat of the land and meet people from all around the world. The motivation for me being on the show was just a chance to do something like a once-in-a-lifetime opportunity to have, you know, to play a game, really. I have also auditioned for Big Brother, and the other show I auditioned for was Making the Band. I whisper that because I'm a little embarrassed by admitting it, but, you know, I think everyone has sort of fantasies about what it would be like to be a rock star and be on stage performing, and that was kind of my interest in drawing me into the audition. I had to go to this office where everyone had a number, and there were thousands of guys there, and you had to pick a song from a list that they had of maybe 10 or 20 songs, and you had to sing a cappella in front of a panel of about five or six people. So there's no music playing. You just had to go in and just, you had about 20 seconds, if you were lucky, to grab their attention and just sing out loud. And if you could dance, then dance. Just show them what you got, you know. It wasn't quite as brutal as the auditions for American Idol that I've been seeing on TV. They weren't like yelling at you or saying you were pathetic. But they kind of looked at me and they asked my age, and I guess I was a little bit too old to be in that sort of thing. Back in 1991, I was on a program called Lip Service on MTV, which is a lip-syncing performance show. And one of the things that I thought was kind of funny was after the show had aired, people were coming up to me on the street and at my job and just being like, oh my God, you look just like that guy that was on Lip Service. And I'd be like, yeah, that was me. And they're just shocked, like their mouths drop. You know, I never had anyone ask me for my autograph, but everyone was always very like, oh my God, I saw you on TV. That's so cool. That was great that you guys won. And it feels good when people recognize you and the attention that they pay to you when they say that they've seen you on TV. I think it did play into my motivation somewhat.
Chris Locke is a video producer living in New York City. On Point is produced by Todd Brubaker, Meghna Chakrabarty, Eileen Imada, Tamar Morad, Virginia Prescott, John Roberts, James Ross, Keith Shields, Karen Schiffman, and Tim Skog. Our senior producer is Graham Griffith. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.
This is WBUR.